you're doing in other areas.
Yeah.
With a show like that. So I might need to call on you to help
out.
Oh,
sure. It's not that, well, I don't want to say it's not that hard to do, because there's a little bit of it that, the security problem is, you got to be careful about.
Yeah.
Because if you set up a website and all this, and you kind of tell yourself you don't want to use the major platforms, right? Like Google and Amazon or something like that to organize Amazon. There's something that doesn't feel right about that, right? And on the other hand, you know, I mean, pretty much on the internet now, if you want to have reliable security, you see how lots of websites are using the major platforms, which have the ability to quickly, you know, get some level of authentication. This person is who they say they are. Because, of course, they have an immense profile on all of their users.
Right.
You know, they can do that. So you're relying upon Google to verify the identity of someone connecting to your site.
Yeah. Well, we have a guy, one of our tech guys is pretty good at this stuff. So he does a lot of our security, stuff. So
you can do
stuff.
If you're a developer, a web developer, you can do it. But I mean, you have to do it, and then you have to test it, you know, and make sure you got it right. And, you know, so I ended up doing that on the site that I use for recruits around here, you know, but it took me, I hadn't done that kind of work since I was working for Netscape. And, you know, it took me 3 or 4 months to actually, you know, get it all done. And,
yeah,
it's a lot of work. Yeah, so I'm sure somebody who does it all the time could have done it quicker.
Maybe.
You know, but
maybe, who knows?
Anyway,
where's JB?
I don't know. He's probably asleep. You know, he doesn't. He resented the. And plus, we didn't get a. He was trying to get a guest yesterday, but then I lost my phone. So maybe you try to get back to me. Well, I can't find it. And it's in the house someplace, you know, but it's dead.
Oh.
And so it's not responding to people calling it. And anyway, I don't know where it is. Yeah, right. So anyway, but let's get started here this morning. And welcome to the Labor Beat Radio program, broadcasting from Enlightened Radio at www.enlightenedradio.org. And my name is John Case, and my good buddy and longtime partner here, comrade in arms, Scott Marshall. I remember when I was on a picket line in Los Angeles, and I was feeling the need for outside support, because we had a very unusual workforce at Carroll Cable, but Scott was always the first to respond, come back when you needed him down in the picket line. So I felt
your memory's better than mine.
I felt better after he showed up, and I just did, you know. But anyway, we had one of these things where I my Spanish consisted of about 40, 50 words, and maybe 60. Okay. Most of which I had learned from, you know, a mutual friend of ours, Evelina Alarcón, who, you know, used to yell at me, you know. So anyway, and the chief steward of the shop we were at there was Manuel was his name. I can't remember what his last name was. Anyway, and he was known in the shop as a comedian. You know, he was kind of like the Zelensky of the shop. And he wasn't and it turned out that the actual people who were running the organization in the shop were the were people who had come from a certain province in Mexico, and I don't remember which one. And they had brought all their relations up over the years, and they had a relationship with the company boss, who was a Austrian social democrat.
Wow.
Oh yeah, strange fellow. Okay. Anyway, yeah. Yeah, he was. He was, and he thought he
funny
liked.
Accent.
Oh, and he liked to sit in on labor negotiations himself. Okay, because he thought it was a wonderful game to bargain with his employees. All right,
oh,
it,
wow.
It just entertained the hell out of him, and you know, he thought he was, and he thought he was a genius at it too. You know, that was one of those little ego trips. You know, he had he had to go. Well, anyway, unbeknownst to me, but the guy who had been servicing the shop before me, Humberto Camacho. You may have met him way back.
Yeah.
And Umberto said, "Be careful, because the guy that runs the shop is the old man in the tool shed and the tool crib." And I says, "What do you mean?" You know, it says half the people in the shop are related to him, and he's the one that decides who gets hired, who gets brought in, and all this stuff. And he had a relationship with the boss, the owner, going way back. Somehow. So, I said, okay, well, this guy didn't show up at the meetings, you know, much. And I finally, after I figured out that the chief steward, who was the comedian, was not really capable of deciding anything, you know, he was a funny guy and everything, but, you know, every time you came to a decision, I don't know. He wouldn't be able to, wouldn't call a vote, wouldn't organize this. So I finally followed Umberto's advice and went back and talked to the fellow. He was past retirement age, but he was still working in the crib. Anyway, and he explained what the terms of a settlement were going to be.
Oh, wow.
And he was right. Anyway, so it's so hot. Yeah, so every shop's different, right? In that way, you know, every local union. It's
absolutely.
And you never it never sort of gets old. The kind of commitment, you know, for example, like this shop, the Sherwin-Williams shop here in, it's actually Williamsport, Maryland, not Cumberland.
Mm-hmm.
Very close to here. Anyway, I mean, there's 40 guys, okay, running a plant that must be almost 5 city blocks long, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, highly automated fluid operation. And these guys, you know, worked all the way through the pandemic. You know, the company couldn't find anybody to come to work in a factory for a while. I mean, anybody knew. And so they made all this thing, and they'd worked there for 20, 25 years through various iterations of the ownership. I don't think it was always owned by Sherwin-Williams. That's a recent development.
Yeah.
But in any event, they, you know, the union is in their soul. And even though everybody goes out and gets jobs, you know, and they're 180 days now on a picket line, and 180 days on a picket line is,
wow.
Ouch.
Ouch.
And they are still committed. And, man, that's a powerful thing.
That seems to be the mood everywhere now. People just stick it out.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Met Coal and
right.
Some of those strikes, and it's just incredible how hard there really is an upswing in people fighting back. I gotta say that.
Yeah, I think that you see it in the front line. Actually, you know, the hiring statistics, you know, the fact that raises are going up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's part, what is the labor shortage? Well, the labor shortage is a shortage at a certain price, right?
Right. That's right.
And, And you see that the unhappiness of the conditions of work,
right,
you know, is what's driving this, you know, like volatility in employment, right? It's not only that there's a shortage, it's that the people are moving from one place to another, to another, to another. And, you know, it's intolerable in one place. You go to the next place and it's not much better. or maybe even worse.
Yeah.
Right? You don't know. And, man, it's just.
Well, there was an interesting thing. I can't remember if it was on TV or where I was hearing it or reading, but there seems to be a pretty big movement of people following the jobs and moving out of certain areas into other areas. And what it seems to be doing is taking a lot of people out of the cities and into the countryside, because, yeah, you know, plants are being built more and more rural areas and,
yep,
all of that kind of stuff. And that's going to create a whole interesting dynamic.
Well, it has. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, it has here, for example, in this county. Now, this is just, you know, a little bit of my own thinking on this, and but you know, last week when we were when Josh saw it, the West Virginia FLCL, right, president was on, and he was sort of letting the Manchin may run as an independent cat out of the bag,
right,
and we had this situation in the state, right, where the Democrats were trying to deal with, you know, liberal questions on the environment, on maintaining, on education, mm-hmm, but they were not basically addressing the poverty of the state. And in fact, they were spent most of their time effectively, you know, attacking the coal industry. And that created a split in the labor movement.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, the leadership of the United Mine Workers or some of the other trades unions that are very much involved in, like, you know, the construction projects that do the natural gas wells and that kind of stuff.
Right.
I mean, all these folks, you know, feel like they're being asked to fall on their swords, you know, and the only actual reward they'll get is, you know, West Virginia's generous unemployment benefits.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that doesn't go anywhere. I mean, anyone that's ever been to a union hall and try to sell that line, you know, you're going to get a lot of resistance. And
well, you know, one of the interesting thing on that whole issue, Cecil Roberts, who I know, we've talked too many times, you know, he's really allied with some people in the
environmental blue green alliance.
Environmental, you know, there's that. I can't remember what the name of the organization is, but he's the president of it, and their main thing is a just transition. And so he's not saying that, you know, coal's the future or anything like that. But what he is saying is that, and this is why he's getting a lot of support from the environmental movement, is because he's saying we've got to have a just transition. We've got to take care of the people that will lose their jobs if the coal mines shut down, if the oil shuts down. And I think that's a very powerful movement gaining ground right now. And the fact that you're getting so much labor support for that, I mean, they're, like you say, there's still splits and stuff like that, but it's still, it's Labor Committee for Sustainability. I just remembered what the name of the thing is. And they've got a broad audience, and they've got a broad audience in coal mining country and stuff like that. And I think that's an important step forward.
But the economics plays out differently in different states. You know, absolutely. I mean, if you're a natural resource, I mean, like, if you have all this wealth underground, right? I mean, and West Virginia has what? It has coal, natural gas, and water, okay? All three in abundance. But if you're whether it's extractive or whether you're doing what another guy I was talking about, the hydrogen hub project, which is not exactly extractive, right. But power generation, you still have the problem of the curse of natural resources phenomenon, right? Where whoever has the most money and guns takes it, and then it doesn't distribute. Right. I mean, it doesn't. There's the ripple effects. So how do you do that? And that becomes a problem. In West Virginia, you have the severance tax is the current existing handle, and you only have that because of Senator Byrd, to be truthful. Okay, before him, there was no tax on it. Mm-hmm. There was a property tax, which was like negligible, right? Right. Now, so the severance tax was almost a revolution in terms of West Virginia's financing. But over time, the coal industry used it to basically buy political support throughout the state, because that severance tax is distributed in part of it by counties. Okay. Uh-huh. And so all of a sudden, you know, every county, county commission and their whatever their budget director is, has to say, well, you know, our assets include ABC, right? and then you have in these rural areas, you know, like in the what do you call it, the extra, not the suburb, but the exurb, I suppose, where you have the either suburban or industrial areas that are overtaking rural lands.
Right.
And, you know, in the essence of the Republican Party is land, at least its origin. It goes way back. And the essence of all the origins of wealth in a capitalist society, right, is property. And land is the best collateral, you might say, okay, for any kind of, well, you know, and so that's why Republicanism is so strong in the rural areas, is because, you know, no matter what you do, I mean, your major relationship with the government is what tax are you paying on your property.
Right.
And so that just creates the counter incentive, whatever. And because the environmental movement in Jefferson County is led by wealthy people who are concerned about damaging their view shed with factories.
Jesus.
Okay? You know?
Oh, the trouble we put them through. Oh, poor babies.
One of the local Democrats asked one of these people, actually, one time. He says, in your title, the deed to your home, does it say anything about your view shed? No. Well, okay. But that's okay. I know, it's not. You just get into these situations where, you know, the economic issues start to have a powerful effect on everybody's thinking.
Those people you're talking about, if they're watching the show, they're going, what are they laughing about?
That's right. I know.
Don't they know how terrible it is?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, let's take a little more complicated topic for a second, because I've been seeing it all week. And, you know, I was asked to compose an article on the financial crisis. And well, so you have five banks that have failed, mostly due to the fact that because they thought the economy was uncertain, they bought government bonds at 2%, which was considered high about 3 years ago. You know, and they were hedging they thought, by doing that, to protect their deposits. But when because of the inflation from the whole many causes, you know, Ukraine, yeah, the pandemic, you know, the Cold War II, it's hard to disentangle all of them, really. And so because of that, you get the inflation boost, and now the Fed starts, it has only one tool, has to raise interest rates, right? And so it raises the base interest rate very fast, faster than Volcker did, by the way, back in 80. Mm. And now treasuries are now selling, of course, at much higher rates. Okay, sort of track with the, and so if you bought a treasury bond 3 years ago, a 10-year bond at 2%, and it doesn't mature until 10 years, okay, but now everyone's buying treasuries at 5, 6, 7%. Your bond is now, okay, you're going to have to wait 10 years to get it all back. But if there's a run on your bank now, you can't sell that bond and raise it. You have it on your account as an asset, but it's not marketable anymore. You know, because no one's going to buy 2 when you can get 5, right? You know?
Right.
And so Silicon Valley Bank, and because of lots of other you look at these banks and you look at what are they, you know, a bank is supposed to loan money and put collateral in its place, okay?
Right.
Because it only keeps about 20% of its cash, total cash on hand. But the theory is if I loan you $100,000 and, I want $100,000 worth of property to back it up or something, you know, in case.
Right.
Well, what's the collateral in these banks? What's being counted as collateral? And man, you know, you look at that and you can, it makes you seasick. I mean, these guys are running high risk operations. And so now you've added this, it's like everyone got a shot of cocaine with these 5% interest rates, right? You know, and no one knows. You can't believe Jamie Dimon, who said, "Oh, when he bought, he's the head of the J.P. Morgan Chase, and now has just broken all the federal bank regulations from the Great Depression because he now has more than 10% of the bank accounts in the United States."
I saw that.
He comes out and says, "No problem. I've taken care of it. We got First Republic. It's done." And then before the week is out, two more banks, PacWest and another one I can't remember, looks like they're going to go under too. And in each case, the government is going to, in order to avoid a national run on the banks, okay, goes in, "Don't worry. I'll guarantee all the deposits. I'll guarantee all the deposits." Okay. And then all the good stuff will be sold to J.P. Morgan again, right? Assuming that they'll take it on, and you know, and we'll socialize the losses and privatize the gains.
Well, you know, there's a really interesting discussion beginning to emerge in all of this that I think is really important, and that is the idea of co-op banks, and you know, there's one in North Dakota,
yep,
which when the last big bank crisis, it was one of the few banks that didn't suffer at all.
That's right.
And it actually got more people coming in. And there are, I mean, it's not a huge thing yet, but there are beginnings of discussions. I've been in several union meetings or labor meetings where people are really actively beginning to discuss that idea, is that maybe, you know, and there's the whole, you know about Mondragon, right?
Yeah, keep talking for a second. I got to step, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a co-op in Spain, I think. No, in that region somewhere. And they have had co-ops going all the way back to World War II. And they've been very successful for their people. And the United Steelworkers Union, which is the union that that I'm affiliated with, the retirees of the Steelworkers Union, but the Steelworkers Union actually made a or I don't know if they joined or whatever, but they have an agreement now to work together with Mondragon. And the idea was is that if we can use the experience of Mondragon to do the same kind of thing here, and you guys will help us get it going, that would be very, very valuable. And it has, it already has done some work. You know, the one of the main, it's not just banking co-ops. They, one of the things that they've already done, and I'm pretty sure this was in Pennsylvania where the steelworkers headquarters are, but anyway, not in Pittsburgh, but in a rural area. There was a plant that was making some kind of aluminum, something or other. I can't remember what it was. Yeah. And so Mondragon said, well, why don't you, the plant's still there. Why don't you take over the plant or buy the plant and start a co-op making? And it was highly successful. They did. All the workers got back to work, including some new ones. And what they were making is those big, I don't know what you call them, but the, the weather ones, the turn, the wind turns.
Oh, I know the pinwheels, the big pinwheels.
Well, the blades on that, they make the
wind turbines, the wind turbines.
Wind turbines.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Boy. Old people in
there. Yeah, geezer radio, then, man.
But they make the blades for that, and they're a thriving business because more and more people are building them. So, you know, I think that whole idea of co-ops is something that, again, I think it's getting some traction that it didn't have before.
But how do you use them for really big projects? In other words, if you're going to move a mountain, you got to accumulate a considerable amount of capital, you know, to be able to do it, you know, really, because you're going to have to hire, you know, 10,000 people and buy 10,000 machines or whatever, you know, and co-ops are not really allowed. There aren't any nonprofits that are really allowed to accumulate funds. You're supposed to spend it all. So how do you get around the ability to accumulate?
I don't think you do right now, but that's the point of building this movement.
I mean, the state, more, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you get, again, it's the beginning of a really important movement. You get people talking about it, get people thinking about it. That's part of how you lead to big, basic changes.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you had people, it's interesting how in the machine shops, because the machinist was a really highly skilled trade, you didn't take much in those shops to convince people that, look, you guys know enough to run this place as well as, mm-hmm. you know, the management, except for you don't have access to the books, you know?
Right.
Basically, you got the skills, and you can. And if you don't have them, you know where you could hire them. Yeah. You know to take care of yourselves. In other shops, you know, there wasn't quite the same set of competence. You know, and actually, people's objectives were actually more limited in a way, you know, more than control over their jobs. You know, there wasn't going to be an easy way to make the job something you would go to if you weren't being well paid for it. Right. It wasn't that kind of an occupation, which is another big question for the labor movement, because I think the whole service side of work, including technical, professional, even actually in some cases managerial,
Right.
Talents, right? You know, you take, for example, the CIA, well, take the UE, my union, okay, where the idea that there should be a cooperation between labor and management. Well, everyone knew, as long as you were working there, there was going to be cooperation. I mean, you're doing the job, right? But on the other, the idea that, you know, the union stance should be, you know, friendly and, you know, backslapping with the management, you know, was always like, Red Block always used to call that the parable of the lion and the lamb, you know, where the lion lies down with the lamb and gets up and burps.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. Red Block was a, I guess his real name was Boris Block. He was the Secretary Treasurer of the UE when I was working for him. Anyway, but nonetheless, and it's true in factory life, right? I mean, even down to, you know, if you were at a union meeting and you said, you know, my boss is, somebody's yelling about what their boss is doing, right? And then someone else says, well, my boss is, you know, he's much better than that. And the old timer would say, when you've been here longer, you'll learn to say that he's just a little less bad.
Then they heard that.
Right. So, but if you're on the service side of the company, of a company, so to speak, and you're dealing with the public all the time, you know, you're selling hamburgers for McDonald's. I mean, whatever. Okay.
Right.
You're, well, you know, the company has to convince you to articulate the company's mission. And you have to agree to sort of do it, even if you don't buy it all, you know. And that's a different kind of relationship to the production process, right? I mean, it's wage labor. I'm not, but it's not quite the same. And then you have, let's say, all the programmers in the software industry, right? Okay.
Right.
That will be a different kind of service. They're also, you know, asked to buy in to the mission of the company, you know, big time. A lot of effort spent on that, you know, by the management. And so you can't, and plus, you know, you're borrowing their intellectual capital, their brain, right? You know, and that whole thing. And they don't own, all of a sudden you can get to the point where the company betrays that trust because it's operating for profit ultimately. And, you know, there's not much else that matters after that. And then you, that sense of alienation can even get, but it's sharp, almost like the old all time, like the factory thing, but it's not quite the same. And it's not articulated quite the same way. Right. I'm not sure what the ultimate end of all that is, except you know, bargaining with the company has to eventually go into saying we have to help run the place, saying with the co-op, right? You know, you in other words, the responsibility. Well, is this company pursuing a mission that has any social utility at all, any public utility at all? And if it does, well, you know, then both the state and the employees should have some say in its top leadership. You know, there should be in this whole business. I can't show you the books to prove that we're making more money out of you this year than last year. You know, that whole thing. You can't do that. But that means you also have to buy into the thing.
You know, it reminds me of something that sort of relevant to this discussion. You know, maybe I've talked to you about this before. I can't remember, but anyway, there is now, and what I'm talking about is the impact of technology on all of this. And there is now, I think it's in Japan, a factory making cars the parts to rolling off the line. That has never been touched by human hands. It's all done by robots. And that level of technology, which is coming to the fore, you know, How is that going to change things? And one of the things about that that is already happening is that a lot of young people go into apprenticeships to try to get decent jobs to make a living and et cetera, et cetera. And now it's because of technology, apprenticeships are evolving, and there's now this idea that learning how to service robots and stuff like that. And these are becoming some of the most sought after apprenticeships by young people because they see where the technology's going. And that, you know, that's going to, but that's just one example of how technology is impacting, this whole, everything we're talking about. And it's, it's accelerating. It's just more and more stuff is being done automatically like that. And so, you know, the question is, for whose benefit and how is that going to happen? And there was one other thing that I wanted to bring up. It's not exactly related, but it's still very interesting to me. You know, if you watch TV and you see all these ads for different products that come on time after time after time.
Yeah.
And if you're honest about it, there's incredible creativity in making these ads. I mean, to what end is another question, but it really is fantastic work. What if that work were done for things like education instead of advertising, for things that people need to learn about instead of advertising? I mean, it's just such a terrible waste of incredible talent. And that's something else that we've got to put into the struggle for workers.
When I was working for one of the startups, I remember we had a product that was a security software product, but it's basically a firewall. And so we were aggressively trying to sell it because it was most of the firewall products were run on dedicated machines and they were run on non-Microsoft platforms. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we had the one that did run on Microsoft. And so we were really, the company wanted to get bought by Microsoft. Just that was their strategic plan from the beginning. And we ended up getting bought by Microsoft. But in the process, you know, you're trying to make it as a little startup, right? And so the sales guys go out and try to get anything, whether it's a paid deal or even a pilot project, anything, so you can establish your credibility in the marketplace, right? This thing works, it doesn't work, whatever, you know. But the sales guys you hire, they lie all the time. And they sell stuff that might be nice, but we actually don't make that. So they would come back, just sold $1 million deal. You know? Oh, really? You know? What'd you tell? Oh, man, they wanted A, B, C, and D. We said we can do all that. I said, tell me again what A, B, C, and D are, you know? And I said, it turns out, you know, we only do A. You know, we don't do BCD. Oh, shit, man. Now you're going to go. And and you would deal this all the time. And so then we would get the CEO, and an Israeli guy in this case, who he was pretty funny. He says, we tell him, the salesmen are out there lying. They're selling vaporware. You know, none of this stuff exists. You know, you want to do a one-off for every single customer, build a whole new product for every single customer like this? He says, no, you guys are 100% right. You know, you're 100% right, you know, and, you know, we'll talk to the sales guy. He says, well, why don't you fire him and replace him? So, he says, all the sales guys are gonna lie, okay? But if they're not out there lying to somebody, you're not gonna get any work. So you know, that he would have this kind of like pragmatic argument, right?
Right.
Anyway, but so I think that you get into part of the whole working class problem is so political. I don't think that unions, as defined under the Taft-Hartley Act, are as constrained under the Taft. It doesn't matter what you look at: Starbucks, Amazon. It's not going to be achieved without becoming a campaign issue by the president of the United States.
Amen.
It's just not, okay? And they're too big. I mean, it's one thing if they had 150,000 workers under one building, but they're spread all over the world.
Right.
And they can move those, they've got those fulfillment centers set up so they can, you know, if necessary, they can reroute from one to another, right? I mean, it would cost them some, I'm sure, but, you know, I just don't see, and that's why, you know, people, read an article the other day criticizing, I couldn't tell what it was from, the City College, CCNY, a big report on independent unionism. And, it wasn't working because ALU President Chris Smalls is riding around the country, becoming a celebrity rather than organizing. And look, he didn't get a contract. So, as if an affiliated union would have a contract right now, I don't think so. Okay, I mean, that part of it, that's a stupid argument in my opinion, but. On the other hand, they turn around and say, oh, well, you know, the AFL-CIO is less relevant than the Little Red Songbook of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which just shows you that college professors' advice to the labor movement is not worth much. I mean, not practically, maybe in a barroom discussion or something like that, but it just doesn't land on planet Earth.
Well, you know, but it's also interesting in that regard how many campuses are organizing.
Well, yes.
Including student teachers and even some places professors. That's true. It's an incredible shift. You know, another aspect of this I think is really important to think about is that, you know, there are always the corporations are always raising issues about international trade and trade agreements and all of that kind of stuff. But one of the things that's happening globally that more and more people are paying attention to is that now unions are becoming much more international in their partnerships. And, you know, my union, the Steelworkers, is in a coalition called the Industrial, which unites industrial unions all around the world. And it's already having an impact on negotiations where, you're trying to settle an agreement here and the company's not budging. But the same company in Europe, the workers start agitating and start threatening to strike, and all of a sudden they start backing down here. And that kind of thing has happened a bunch of places. And actually, they have a weekly newsletter where they kind of, again, it's all over the world. And it's not always the U.S. by any means. But they talk about the agreements that are being reached and the new people that are coming into the coalition and stuff like that. And that's a trend that's going to be ongoing, too. I mean, that's another trend that's inevitable. Because so much of production now is global, and so much of you know, anyway.
Let's take up one additional issue before we part ways again. The debt ceiling crisis is about to intervene on nearly everything. Simultaneous with that, and in some ways it's kind of misleading to take these little things on a piece at a time, even though it's hard to do it otherwise. Mm-hmm. But you have the debt ceiling crisis, which is, we don't know yet whether exactly how serious it is, but it's starting to look serious, okay? And simultaneous with that, you have this Joe Manchin phenomenon, okay, which we don't yet know. But that could end up, depending on how it plays, that could play both a role in the debt ceiling showdown as well as the presidential elections, you know, coming up. And then the third thing is that ABC Washington Post poll, you know, you can't believe a single poll, but said that I mean, Trump is winning in the Republican Party, and for the first time polled ahead of Biden on some, I don't know how reliable that is, but which means that, which adds a little bit of fuel to the supposed Manchin hypothesis about, well, there's going to be a large part of the Republican Party that even though they can't beat him, Trump, they're not going to go Democrat, you know, but whatever. Nonetheless, the theory that there's a non-Trump base in the Republican Party that's sizable. But you can see how the combination starts to get very in the midst of a very fragile economic environment. In which there's aroused labor agitation in a number of areas. Okay, it hasn't quite converged into. It's hard to predict how it's going to converge. We just have to sort of get our boats and get in the river. But anyway, this is the confusion of all these particular things. I mean, how do you? I know you've been watching them too. It seems like a storm. It always seems like a storm is building, right?
Yeah, I have to say I don't. I always try to stay hopeful, but it's really hard to tell. Right. I mean, and it's like you say, there's so many trends going on with it. It's just incredible. And I don't know. I feel like that the mood for fight back is really growing, and you know. But the question is, what form can it take? What form will it take?
Right.
I really don't think the polling is all of that accurate.
I don't know.
And I do think that there are some pretty serious splits in the Republican Party. And there really are, I think, more than people realize, people who reject what Trump is proposing and doing.
And what he stands for. Yeah, right.
What he stands for. Exactly. So that's a hopeful thing, too. And one of the things that I worry about is I don't think Biden can't just sort of take a mild point of view on this stuff. I think he's got to come out much more forcefully for the right things. And for, you know, and a lot of people think that's dangerous and it's, you know, it's going to, but I don't think so. I think people are really looking for solutions that are for real. And I think, especially working people, they just, you know, and not just working people, middle class people too. But I just think people are really looking for some sound solutions for things. And if Biden doesn't come out swinging, I think it could be. I think it would be, let me put it in a more positive way. I think it would be a whole lot better and stronger if he did that, if he came out really tackling some of the key issues in a sharp way, in a militant way.
Yeah.
I think that would encourage a lot of people.
I don't see how, but in terms of constructive solutions, there's hardly any that don't go in the direction of more socialism in one form or another. I mean, there aren't any. I mean, what, more privatization of the things, more contracting out, more, really?
Exactly. Really.
I mean, how many problems is that going to create versus something it might solve? You know, oh, yeah. You know,
and part of what gives, and we see this with young people, we see this with all kinds, I mean, in the labor movement, what gives people hope is seeing people fighting and seeing strong movements on issues. And that's why I think Biden's moving in that direction, but I still think it's got to be even stronger than it is now.
Well, I mean, the Democratic Party coalition appears to be, I mean, keep in mind, I mean, you have the billionaire anti-Trump coalition, which includes the owner, which Bezos and these guys that all hate Trump.
Right.
Okay. And they're 10,000 times richer. And every one of them is playing politics in the past decade or two, okay?
That's right.
So that's the, I mean, I and it's hard to believe that they don't, I mean, that's the problem with Biden, you know? I mean, these big corporations, they want to take over the world, and the military agrees, and Biden's going full steam with that. I don't think that's going to... there's no winners down that road, as far as I can tell. And that's not going to help him. You know, everybody thinks, oh, well, let's go back. When we did, you know, like imperialism, we call it, right? You know, spread out all over the world, you know, and we'll just, the pickings will be great, you know, and they probably were for 25, 30 years now, but last 40, not much. Nothing. And it's getting worse. And plus, everybody, all these failed states everywhere. If you get a failed state, where do you go?
Right.
Well, let's go to the U.S. Why not? You know, they created the mess. Why don't we go there?
and the racism and the fascism in all of these failed states is an incredible thing too. I mean, there really is a global fascist danger.
There is, you know. And the people think that you can exploit it, you know, some people, right? Oh, we can use them, you know, they're like little weapons. I don't know.
But I have to say again, I when I see the response of young people, when I see the response of the labor movement, I mean, take these organizing drives, the Starbucks and the Amazon unions. I mean, if you look at the way they see fighting back and, you know, for example, this whole idea that I think both Amazon and Starbucks are saying that they want national agreements.
Well, they have to have them. They can't win without them. Yeah.
But remember in history what that meant in terms of the CIO. And the strength of the labor movement when we first started fighting for that kind of thing. So I also see that side of things. And I think that that's the leading edge of some really important change.
But just imagine what it would take to achieve that in terms of the role of the, it's not going to be just a trade union thing at all.
No.
I mean, again, I'd say like the president of the United States would have to be part of the, probably end up having to be drawn into force him to sign the contract, sign the agreement.
But, another side of that is, again, in real life, look at the coalitions that the AFL-CIO is building with the anti-racist movements and the Black Lives Matter and the women's movement. And, you know, that coalition is growing and growing and growing. And they're bringing in, you know, you're getting forward motion in churches. You're getting, you know, the famous I-we curve. Right now, people are getting into their organizations, and you know, some of the churches, some of the positions that they're taking on these issues is just incredible. And I think that's a real trend.
That's true, and what do I call the mainstream churches around here are doing that too, but they're also, their membership is in decline. At least around here, young people are not doing it. For example, it's in Shepherdstown, a little town 12 miles up the river from here, but it's where the college is. They're not able to really afford to do any public services, like the park commission, there was a food delivery services during the 2008 recession, and a number of other properties and that volunteers from the churches for years, especially from the Ecumenical Council of Churches, those that were part of that, they staffed it, okay, unpaid. So, but now all those people are 80, you know, and the young people have not come in behind, okay? So they've had to shut down public facilities because they don't have enough tax revenue. The towns in West Virginia don't have very little taxing authority. They don't really have the ability to fund it. So you see this the decline in participation in these kind of churches reflected a decline in volunteerism in the community. Now, the right-wing churches, I call them that because they really are political. They're attracting a lot of people. They have more money, and they have internal programs like 12-step programs or home visiting. If you're a member of the church and your kids are sick and you're having a hard time getting to work, they'll come by your house and bring food. They'll do things. Okay. So internal things. If the church is, but of course they're also organizing people to, you know, vote Trump. You know, so. And anyway, but in the public square also doesn't get strengthened because of that, because it's actually been taking place private. These services are now being delivered privately. So they're only accessible if you're, I presume, a loyal member and, you know, generous with your tithe. You know, so I'm not sure that the community organization level here, I don't see it getting stronger right now. I don't know. And it's hard to find, what do you replace that with? You know, but
well, you know what that means?
No, tell me.
It means we got a lot of work to do.
That's for sure.
We got a lot of organizing to do, a lot of fight back to do.
Well, that's a good tone to stop on today, and we'll have this as a podcast. We got, by the way, if you know somebody from Michigan that could talk about, I talked to Steve the other day, our friend Steve Nalke, but he's working right now, so this is not a good time for him. Right. But I'd like to get somebody from Michigan, if you know anybody that would, on details on how they reversed the right to work.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think that's an important discussion. We raised it last week with Josh, and you notice see the polls on reproductive rights in West Virginia are not the same as in Michigan.
Right.
You know, they're actually, they're not flipped, but I think it would be optimistic to say they're 50-50. Okay. Anyway, you know, notwithstanding all the stuff about who gets polled and everything like that, but you know, anyway. All right. Well, this is I think we've touched on all the mainstream things going on now. Let me say goodbye for this week, and let me turn off the tape for a minute. cut that little part in the end.